Okay. For those of you who weren't here last time, let's do a little quick review. We talked about the crisis of the third century for the Romans. They had military problems, they had economic problems, they had political problems, bad time for them. We talked some about the relations between Christians and the Roman Empire prior to Constantine. We said that persecution was sporadic and local, mainly. And even when it was empire-wide, it really depended a lot on your own local officials, whether how much problems you were going to have as a Christian. We talked about the Emperor Diocletian at the end of the 3rd century, his very brilliant reforms, excuse me, but also his unprecedented persecutions of Christians, which lasted for about 10 years. Then there was a period of about 8 years where there was a lot of strife, jockeying for position for the new emperor after Diocletian retired. That was unique among Roman emperors, he retired. And finally, Constantine won a military victory at a place called the Milvian Bridge outside of Rome, winning from an inferior position, fewer men, maybe half as many men, under the sign of the Chi Rho, which is the first two letters of the word Christ in Greek. It's a Christian symbol. We talked about Constantine's reign as emperor, how he, to use the phrase of Caesar Augustus, made haste slowly as regards reforms. He did them, but he did them slowly. He didn't want to upset anybody. He called the Council of Nicaea in 325. We talked about the fact that Constantine's conversion was probably genuine. It's a matter of opinion, but seems to me it was probably genuine. It was also very unexpected, and it was a real surprise. It was a huge turning point in Western civilization, changing the identity that determined your position in the Roman world from are you a Roman citizen to are you a Christian, and starting a trend that would lead to a nearly 100% Christian Europe for the next well over 1,000 years in Europe. If you're not a Christian, then you're a Jew probably, or possibly a Muslim for a very small minority. At the end, we talked about whether this was a good thing or not. It's hard to find fault with when Constantine didn't support Christianity, but we asked in the final analysis if it was a good thing to have the world we got, which includes putting Christianity in league with the government, persecutions against non-Christians, which haven't started yet, but we're going to hear about those tonight, and eventually forced conversions, versus having Christianity remain what it was, which is a persecuted minority. We didn't answer that question. We just let that as an exercise for the student. So tonight we're going to take a look at three more emperors. Julian the Apostate, Theodosius the First, or Theodosius the Great. He's going to be our sort of main guy for tonight. And Justinian, to follow the course of the Christianization of the Roman Empire. We're going to deliberately avoid, sorry Jan, talking about barbarians. Because barbarians is a big topic, and probably I'll do a section on barbarians next fall. One note here, too. After the Council of Nicaea, the term Catholic starts to become more and more used in that time. You might ask, does that mean universal or Roman Catholic? And the answer is yes. It was a term used to denote what we would now call Orthodox Christians, that is to say, to distinguish them from the various heretical sects, like especially Arians and Monophysites, and we're going to talk about them tonight. So that's when somebody called you a Catholic at that time, they were distinguishing you from those heretical positions. Since the Bishop of Rome consistently came down on the side of these issues that we today would call Orthodox, it was both universal Orthodox and Roman Catholic Christianity together. All right, so Julian the Apostate. Julian was born in 331. And he was a nephew of Constantine. If you remember last time, we said that Constantine's reign ran till about 340, I think. He was a nephew of Constantine who was raised as a Christian and spent his formative years in Cappadocia here, in what is now Turkey, what was then called part of Asia Minor. He studied the Greek classics there, and about 350 he came back to Constantinople, which is on this map, because this is the Apostolic Age, it says Byzantium there. That city got renamed when Constantine moved the capital there in 330. He spent some years in Constantinople and there, between there and Ephesus. Ephesus is down the coast here of, this is, they call it Asia, that's the Roman province name. So he was knocking around in this area for a few years. He came under the, he was theologically trained. It seemed he would become the Patriarch of Constantinople eventually. But while he was traveling around in Northwest Asia Minor, he came under the influence of two Greek teachers there, and he secretly converted to paganism when he was about 20. By the mid-350s, there was no one left to be heir to Constantius II. That was Constantine's son, who was emperor at the time. And all the other heir apparents had died out. So Constantius II named Julian as his heir, and then he sent him to Gaul, up here, what we now call France, to turn back some barbarians, some barbarian invasions. Julian read up on his Julius Caesar, because that was Julius Caesar's famous area of conquest. He went and cleaned all the barbarians out of Gaul for the very first time in about 46 or 47 B.C. So he read up on his Julius Caesar. He went to Gaul. He won a bunch of brilliant victories, and he came back from those a hero, at least to the people in the West and the Western armies. In 360, with Julian still in Gaul, the Sassanid Persians, out here and off the map this way, started to cause trouble in the East, and Constantius II sent word that he now wanted the Western army in the East. Well, that's a long way. That's easily an over 2,000-mile march. And the Western army said, not happening. And they just can't say it that way. They have to have their own leader. So they made Julian emperor, which is sort of typical for those times in the Roman Empire. Emperors got made and unmade in strange fashion. So they declare Julian emperor, and that means a civil war is on, but it's not yet being actually fought. At that point, Julian revealed his pagan religion, and the army eventually started to march west toward this civil war. But before it got to Constantinople, Constantius II, who was emperor, fell ill, and he did something which was really very wise and very good, sort of out of step with the times. He recognized Julian as his heir. Even though he knew he was a pagan and this was going to be a problem, he thought things would be worse if he didn't just put him on the throne. So he recognized him officially as his heir and died. So Julian became emperor in the fall of 361. Julian did not make haste slowly as an emperor, and he decided he was going to turn this whole Christianity thing around. His first act was to restore pagan worship in the city of Constantinople. He cut off funding to the Christians, and he allowed, and he in fact encouraged Christians to sue each other in the courts over which person should be bishop in what cities. That was one of the things he was really good at, was stirring up trouble between Christians. He was smart. This was a smart guy. He was no dummy. He also began to organize a pagan counter-church, and he funded it. He made an ordo for pagan priests. Ordo is a legal order, and if you belong to an ordo, that means you have more rights than the average Roman citizen. So he made an ordo for pagan priests, just like Constantine had done for Christian bishops. He understood the power of the Christian hierarchy, and he tended to take it over with a pagan hierarchy, and he was going to call it the Hellenistic Church. He styled himself as a new Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius was a Roman emperor, who ruled back in the second century. He was the last of the five good emperors. There's a series of emperors there, starting with Trajan, that they call the five good emperors. Marcus Aurelius was, in his own right, an important Stoic philosopher, and he was a committed pagan who also persecuted Christians. And this is who Julian, he was sort of styling himself after Marcus Aurelius. Julian forbade Christians from teaching the classics, the Greek classics, like Homer's Iliad and Odyssey and the Aeneid and things like that. He promulgated a law that said that teachers may only teach and students may only learn material that they believed in. So that automatically cut off Christians from teaching the secular classics. This was a severe financial blow because it deprived Christian scholars, tutors, and teachers of many students, and was bitterly resented as it relegated Christians to second-class status. Julian made explicitly legal various forms of Christianity. He didn't have to do this. They already were legal, but he made laws making them explicitly be legal, hoping to cause trouble between them, and with some success. He took away a church property in some instances, gave it to pagans. And when Christians objected, Julian quoted Christ's parable about it being easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to go through heaven and to go to heaven. And he said he was making their salvation more sure in taking away their property. Cute. He didn't really do any persecuting of Christians, although he had a few soldiers executed who refused to take Christian symbols off their shields. Many historians believe he would have started persecutions had he had the time. Julian supported the Jews, and he helped them in rebuilding Jerusalem. As an aside, too, we didn't really talk about this last time, but the conversion of Constantine to Christianity and the Christianization of the empire really marginalized the Jews in the Roman Empire. They went to being third-class citizens, not only second-class. And, of course, this was the beginning of a long slide for the Jews as they were frequently mistreated in medieval times as well. Although Julian was very popular with the military, he actually didn't turn out to be really popular with many citizens, even pagans. Educated pagans thought his fondness for animal sacrifice was crude, and less educated pagans found his philosophical pretenses to be kind of off-putting. In 362, just a year after he became emperor, Julian went east, visiting many pagan tribes in Asia Minor here along the way, to fight against the Sassanid Persians out here in what's labeled on this map as Mesopotamia. They arrived in the... It was a mess. He arrived in the blazing heat of summer there, and the campaign was just a disaster. And Julian himself was killed in June of 363. So he was only emperor for a couple of years. Whoever could get the army out now of Persia was by default going to be the next Eastern emperor. And it turned out to be a guy by the name of Jovian, who was a Christian. So now we're back to Christian emperors again, and Julian's little experiments started to get turned back around the other way. So now we're going to fast forward about 16 years or so to Theodosius. Theodosius was the final critical turning point in the empire. In some ways, he marks the beginning of medieval Christianity. He reigned from 379 to 395. He was the last emperor to rule both the East and the West. And as long as we're talking about that, let's talk about the dividing line. You can see here the Danube and the Rhine are the main dividing lines here. This is the Danube flowing along here, and then it makes this, flows along in this direction and makes this huge right turn going north to south. That's part of the dividing line between east and west. And then that lines up very nicely with the edge of the Balkan Peninsula. So right there is the dividing line between the east and west parts of the Roman Empire. Arianism had made a big comeback since the Council of Nicaea. But if you remember the Council of Nicaea, they talked about the Trinitarian forms. Arianism was the heresy that said that Christ is really a created being. He's like the first of the created beings, but he's not divine. And although it would seem like the Council of Nicaea would put an end to that, by no means did it do so. The guy who argued in the Council of Nicaea for Arianism was Eusebius of Nicomedia, as opposed to Eusebius of Caesarea, who's the Christian historian. But Eusebius of Nicomedia didn't take that as a final no. He started to work on Constantine and tried to get close to him, and he eventually did, and he became a confidant of Emperor Constantine. Eventually, when Constantine was baptized, Eusebius of Nicomedia baptized him. And so Arianism started to get more and more of a foothold. And in fact, by the time of Theodosius, Arianism was, at least in the East, easily the most widespread form of Christianity. Nicene Christianity was in a tremendous minority here. That's not true in the West. And all along throughout the Roman Empire, if you want to look for the heresies, they're mostly out in the East. This is where people kind of went off kilter in a lot of different directions. In the West, that really didn't happen so much. In fact, a lot of the most orthodox church fathers are from out here in the West, including Tertullian and Irenaeus here in Lyon. The Bishop of Rome, the Pope, was always on the side of the Orthodox. So, Theodosius, however, was a committed Nicene Christian. And this makes a big difference now, because he's gonna turn Arianism on its head. One little example I had here of how much of an issue this still was in that day. Gregory of Nazianzus, who was an early church father from Cappadocia, wrote one time that it was impossible to even get your shoes repaired without getting into an argument about whether the sun was homoousios, the same substance, or homoiousios, a similar substance with the Father. So it was a big deal in those days. The empire had become relatively unstable after Julian's death. In 378, an emperor by the name of Valens was defeated by the barbarian Visigoths at the town of Adrianople, which is right about here in northern Greece. Theodosius took over in the east after Valens got defeated at Adrianople, starting in 379. He did an excellent job of getting things stabilized. He started with real problems here in the Balkans and on the Danube frontier. He begins by rebuilding the Roman army. He made peace with Anathoric, who was the king of the Visigoths at that time. The Visigoths, another way is to talk about them, is the Western Goths. When we do the barbarians, we're going to talk a lot about them. He settled them down in the Balkans. And they were allowed to govern themselves. They agreed to defend the frontier, and for this they were given land and paid a cash subsidy. This was similar to what Constantine had done with some barbarians. However, these agreements in Constantine's times were always made with people who were outside the border of the empire. Now they're inside. One thing that the Visigoths learned from this was that rebellion pays. They rebelled, and usually when you rebelled against the Romans, you got ground into the dust. Okay, didn't happen to the Visigoths. They got what they wanted. And this is going to come back to haunt the Romans. Religious strife occupied Theodosius constantly. In 379 and 380, he passed a series of laws that effectively made Catholicism the state religion of Rome. And in those, he said that all Christians must believe as the Bishop of Rome believes. We talked about this last time, that was another thing that gave the Bishop of Rome some authority, and people asked, why was the Bishop of Rome made the Pope, why was he the Pope? Well, that's one of the reasons. He got support from the empire. Arianism and other heresies are now outlawed. And paganism isn't outlawed yet at this point in 380. In 381, Theodosius summoned the Second Ecumenical Council, which met at Constantinople. It bolstered the language of the Nicene Creed, especially regarding the Holy Spirit, and really ended Arianism as an issue. No Arian bishops were even allowed to attend that council, so if you were an Arian, you were really on the outs. The council put Constantinople on an ecclesiastical footing second only to Rome. In 391, Theodosius passed laws that outlawed pagan worship and sacrifice. So now we've completed the legal maneuvers, and now the definition of Roman is going to depend on your religion, and unofficial persecution of pagans starts at this point in 391. One unfortunate result of this is that some monks become less than peaceful. Some of them, not a majority, but some saw themselves as God's troops to stamp out paganism. Outright murder was rare, but destruction of pagan temples and forced conversions became common in some areas of the East. And talk about an incident that happened at Thessalonica, right here. It's called the Massacre of Thessalonica. By the late 4th century, it was fairly common for barbarian troops to be in league with Romans and employed by them in various tasks. There was a local Gothic garrison near Thessalonica to help guard the northern area of northern Greece from other barbarians. So, here we're not going to spend much time on this, but, we're employing barbarians to keep out the barbarians. And you can see where this is maybe going to lead to some trouble. Sports fans back then were about as rabid as they are now, especially for chariot races. That was the big thing. And the local Gothic commander had a popular charioteer arrested. The population went into an uprising against the Goths, and the commander and others were killed. Theodosius at this time was in Milan. He was keeping his capital there in the north of Italy. And when he heard about this uprising, he got very angry, and he ordered that it be put down harshly. He started to give that some thought after the messenger took off, heading for Thessalonica, and he countermanded that order the next day, I think it was, fairly soon. But the countermanded order didn't get there in time, and some 7,000 people were massacred in the city. And of course, he's in Milan, he's there with Bishop Ambrose, okay? When Ambrose heard about that, he rebuked Theodosius. Now remember, this guy's an emperor. He rebuked Theodosius, barred him from the Eucharist, and prescribed him to do penance. With most emperors, that would have gotten Ambrose killed. But to Theodosius' credit, he took the heat. And he did his penance for 8 months. 8 months later, he repented. He enacted a law that put a 30-day lag between the order of an execution and the carrying out of that order. And Ambrose finally readmitted Theodosius to the Eucharist. So you see an emperor go under church discipline and take it. Pretty interesting anecdote there. Some unfortunate things happened in Alexandria, here at the mouth of the Nile. Under Theodosius, Alexandria had the best library in the ancient world, some 700,000 scrolls. And shortly after Theodosius passed his laws forbidding pagan sacrifice, the Patriarch of Alexandria sent his monks to attack the pagans who occupied the temple to the god Serapis, which also housed the library. The pretense was that the pagans were secretly sacrificing in underground sanctuaries. The pagans objected, and they occupied the Serapeum and the library to try to protect them. The monks and a large crowd of Christians attacked them, smashed statues, destroyed papyrus scrolls, lots of them, almost all of them. The fighting spread across Alexandria, and the imperial army did nothing. Classical Alexandria was destroyed, and Christian Alexandria emerged. This is seen by many scholars as a real turning point in relations between Christians and pagans. Now the pagans are afraid, and with good cause. Theodosius' laws outlawing paganism and making Christianity the official religion of the empire didn't sit well in the West or with the Roman Senate, still in Rome. The Western army, under the Frankish general Arbogast, now Frankish is another group of barbarians who are settled up here. Well, they're not yet at this point settled up here, but they're going to be soon. And they came from here. They settled up here in the north of France. We're going to hear more about them when we do the barbarians. But now we've got a general in the Roman army who's a barbarian. Okay, Arbogast, his name was. So the Western army under the Frankish general Arbogast, with the blessings of the Senate, declared a pagan man named Flavius Eugenius as Western emperor in 392. Ambrose thundered against him from the pulpit. Ambrose did a lot of those kind of polemical sermons. Theodosius was distressed by this apparent pagan revival in the West. When Western ambassadors later arrived in Constantinople, where Theodosius had now moved from Milan, to request that Eugenius be acknowledged as the Western emperor, the Western Augustus, Theodosius was non-committal. Later, Theodosius made up his mind and early in 393 named his 8-year-old son Honorius as the Western Augustus. So this could only mean one thing again, civil war. In 394, the Western and Eastern armies were marching toward each other. Theodosius coming from this way, and the Western army was coming up. I think they were actually down in Rome at this time, and they came up that way. Theodosius' Roman forces were bolstered by 20,000 Visigothic troops under Alaric. So now we've got barbarians fighting for the Romans. They met at a place called the Frigidus River in modern-day Slovenia, which is right about up here, right in this little highest corner of the Adriatic, right up here. Theodosius was outnumbered, just like Constantine was, but a fierce storm blew up at his back and blew right into the faces of the Western forces. Now again, different sources give you different, slightly different interpretations of this. Some say that hail blew into the faces of the Western forces, some say it was just dust. But whatever it was a big storm and it was driving into the faces of the Western army. So the Western forces were defeated, although a total of 50,000 soldiers died in that battle. The Roman Senate surrendered unconditionally to Theodosius. This was hailed by Christians as a second Milvian bridge, okay? Outnumbered, something happened that looked like it was maybe miraculous on their side. This was the final turning point. Never again would paganism threaten to return to the Roman Empire. Christian monarchy was never again in question. Also at this point, educated pagans begin to disappear. Roman citizenship and identity was now based on religion, and those who didn't fall in line were subject to the punishment of the law. This, unfortunately, is the first step toward the persecuting society of medieval Europe. So again, here we have the good and the bad. Arianism is wiped out, and that's good because Arianism is a serious heresy. but at the same time has gone hand in hand with it, this persecution of non-Christians. Theodosius died soon after the Frigidus River, and his unworthy sons, Honorius in the west and Arcadius in the east, come to the throne, and thereby begins the crumbling of the Roman Empire. Okay, we're going to move now to Justinian. Justinian ruled from 527 to 565, so we've jumped now 130 years forward from the end of Theodosius' reign. In Theodosius' time, maybe the Roman world was maybe 50-50 in terms of Christian and pagan. The cities were more Christian, but there was still a lot of pagans out in the country. By the time Justinian died, the Roman world really was pretty much completely Christianized. A lot had happened in the 130 years since Theodosius. The Western Empire had crumbled with the last Western emperor, that is, the emperors who were in Rome. They actually moved the capital to Ravinia, but that's almost neither here nor there. The last Western emperor had been deposed in 476, and all of Western Europe and North Africa was now in barbarian hands. At the beginning of Justinian's rule, the Balkans, so in here, Greece, Asia Minor, Syria, and Egypt are what's left of the Roman Empire. All this stuff all in here. And all the rest of it is in barbarian hands. Now Christians were by far the majority, as we said. Between Theodosius and Justinian, some laws were added akin to those Julian had used against Christians, but this time against pagans, like laws against pagans teaching in the imperial government. The Greek East and the Latin West were now on separate trajectories, and the languages, once used in both places, became purely Greek in the East and purely Latin in the West. Soon the historical Roman era ends and the Byzantine era is now beginning. Justinian was very pious. He had an interest in theology from a very young age. He used to write letters to the Pope, and he had a church built and dedicated to the apostles Peter and Paul when he was young, before he became emperor. First, we'll talk a little bit about Justinian's military activity. Starting in 532, he began an ambitious program to reconquer at least important parts of the Western Empire under his top general, Belisarius. He starts by successfully conquering the Vandals in North Africa. It's another barbarian group that we'll talk about who had taken over all of North Africa. And they're the ones, when Augustine lay dying, and he could see the flames in Hippo Regius, the city that he lived in, they were the ones that took over that city. So Justinian decides, we've had enough of this, and we're going to go get these guys. He had a big job to do. So he started out, and he was able to defeat the Vandals, and they took over North Africa again. In 534, he begins a long campaign to retake Italy, which was at that time in the hands of the Ostrogoths, the Eastern Goths, as opposed to the Visigoths, who were the Western Goths. That campaign that he started in 534 went on for 20 years until 554. In some sense, it was successful in that the Ostrogoths were ousted from Italy, but in other sense, the war left the Italian peninsula really devastated, and the Eastern Empire simply did not have the strength to hold Italy in the fold for the future. It was during these times, during that war, that the Roman Senate finally ceased to function after 1,000 years of functioning. The Roman Senate began in about 500 BC, and it functioned all the way until about 540 AD. So the cure in Italy was definitely worse than the disease, as the Ostrogoths had actually been reasonably good rulers there. These reconquering adventures left the empire overtaxed and weak, and nearly led to its downfall in the first part of the 7th century. At this time, the imperial army was definitely Christian. All the Roman armies go into the battle under the sign of the cross. All battles that they, you know, if the battle didn't come upon them suddenly, if today they were going to get up and go fight a battle, they first had a sermon. And they feel their armies are fighting now in the name of God. Now we'll talk a little bit about Justinian's ecclesiastical activity. The Hagia Sophia, which means holy wisdom, church had been built actually a couple of times made out of wood, starting in the reign of Constantius II in the late 350s. However, it had burned down twice. Justinian, in 532 to 537, reconstructed it in its present form. When it's finished, it is recorded that Justinian walked into it and said, "Solomon, I have outdone you." He was also responsible for a whole new wave of building large basilican churches, cathedral churches, not only in the East, but also in the West. The big division in the Eastern Church was no longer Arianism. Arianism was gone, but it was now Catholic versus Monophysite. And there were Nestorians as well. Monophysites believed that Christ had essentially one nature, divine, and that his humanity was swallowed up in his divinity, as they would say, like a drop of honey in the sea. Nestorians believed that Christ's natures were very loosely united, and that the person of Jesus really had only one nature, which was human, although the divine Christ still existed somewhere and sort of indwelled Jesus. The 4th century was the time of Trinitarian heresies. The 5th and 6th century was the time of all the heresies surrounding the nature and person of Christ. Justinian made a major bid to unite the Christian church by calling the Council of Ephesus in 431 and especially the Council of Chalcedon in 451, which was the fourth ecumenical council. They built on the Council of Nicaea and further took on the problem of the divine and human natures of Christ, Chalcedon condemning the Monophysite position that Christ had a single divine nature. It also added some language to the Nicene Creed regarding Christ. So the Nicene Creed, as we recite it in church, does have the language of Nicaea in it, but it also got additional language from Constantinople in 381, and some more, that was about the Holy Spirit, and some more about Christ's nature from Chalcedon in 451. Justinian attempted to unite Catholic Christians by finding common enemies, Jews, pagans, and heretics like Arians. He pushed his reforms out into the country and villages, etc., by getting the bishops of the cities to work harder on missions and proselytizing. It's said that the bishop of Ephesus here went out and spent time in the countryside for a couple of years around there on mission work and produced 80,000 new converts, which is astounding. That's a huge number. Okay, political and legal activity from Justinian. He was a busy guy. Starting in 528, he appointed a commission to gather all of Roman jurisprudence together and write a massive digest of the theory behind the law and produce a codex of laws and theory intermixed to be used for teaching. Altogether, they constitute the most influential law book ever published in human history. It was a monumental undertaking. Justinian ordered a crackdown on crypto-pagans in his administration in 529. These were people who acted like Christians publicly, but privately kept on doing pagan worship. A number of high officials were caught, and Justinian regarded pagan worship as black magic, to be in league with Satan. So these officials were given an opportunity to renounce their paganism and re-embrace Christianity. Virtually all of them did. However, in 1542, there was a major outbreak of bubonic plague, the first one in Europe. There was a major loss of life, 230,000 people in Constantinople alone. That's a third of the population. the Gothic Wars at that point, they were still fighting these wars at that time in Italy against the Ostrogoths. They weren't going very well at that point. So Christians around the time of 545 read these problems much like the pagans had in the 3rd century. That the pagans in Rome in the 3rd century felt that it was the disfavor of the gods that they were having all these problems. Christians in 545 concluded that they had the disfavor of God Almighty against them. So Justinian decided he better find out where the problems were, and he had another crackdown on crypto-pagans in 546. Many of the same people that were caught in 529 were caught again in 526, and this time they were executed. So now we've taken, you know, along with some progress, we've taken another step down here in executing people who are pagans. Justinian also ordered the first forced baptisms of Jews that we have on record at a town in North Africa. It was only one instance, one town. Can't find any explanation of the reason for it, but it was the very first time that happened. He also forbade the Jews to read the Torah in Hebrew. They had to use the Septuagint, which is in Greek. The idea was that if they read Greek, perhaps they might eventually convert to Christianity. Justinian made a concerted effort to remove cult statues from frontier areas and from great sanctuaries such as Olympia, Delphi, and Athens, and bring them to Constantinople, where they were turned into park elements, art emptied of their religious content. He also made concerted efforts to convert people beyond the imperial frontier. Justinian demanded that all pagans present themselves for instruction in the Christian faith. He forbade the keeping of brothels, he limited the grounds for divorce, and he prosecuted homosexuals. At the end of Justinian's reigns, there was no longer any pagan intellectuals. The academy, the Platonic Academy at Athens, came to an end, and the intellectuals at Alexandria were also Christians at this point. So for the next 12 centuries, a civilized individual in the West was somebody who was a Christian and was an heir to the imperial church of Constantine, Theodosius, and Justinian. And for the next 12 centuries, the notions of divine and the ethical are going to come out of this age. And that's it for tonight, and take any questions that you've got.
You mentioned yes. The church that had been built twice, that was the Sophia?
Hagia Sophia.
And would that have been at Constantinople?
Yeah, and it's still there today.
It's a mosque, isn't it? Is it a mosque?
I don't think it's a mosque anymore.
When it was a mosque, and now maybe it's like a museum.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Theodosius, when he took over, I think we were talking before we started about how Constantinople is situated. It's on a peninsula. And when the city was founded by Constantine, he put a wall along the land part of it. And Theodosius moved that, well, he built another wall much farther back to give him more room and much more fortified. It started with a 20-foot wide, 20-foot deep moat. And it had a huge wall that bordered that moat. And that wall went way down into the ground, so you couldn't tell underneath it. Then there was 30 yards of nothing, and then there was another, even bigger wall that was like 12 feet thick and 40 feet high and went way down into the ground. So he built this enormous fortification behind Constantinople so that to make it hard to get in. And that's why they lasted till 1453. But the empire kept shrinking, mostly under attack from Muslims. They would have fallen hundreds of years before that had they not had that huge fortification behind them. You couldn't attack them from the sea. Impossible. Almost impossible. But the Hagia Sophia is in that city, and it's there today, and it was when they finally lost the city in 1453. It got turned into a mosque, but I think it's a church again now. There's mosques all around it. When you see a picture, there's, you can see minarets. Bruce has been there.
My daughter was there.
Okay. Did she visit it? Yeah. I guess it's quite impressive.
Yes. In Venice, last March, they talked about why that city was built the way it was. And I don't remember the year, but they talked about protecting themselves from the northern invaders. Would that have been in that period of time where the barbarians were coming out of the north to...
What was it about Venice that protected them?
They built the city out into the Adriatic Sea.
Right.
Basically,
okay.
So that the boats coming from the south couldn't come up because it was too shallow. And isn't that, do you remember? But I don't remember the time frame. I was thinking it was the 4th century.
It may have been that early. I don't know when Venice was founded. That's exactly the same reason they moved the capital from Rome to Ravenna up here. Ravenna was surrounded by swamps, and it was right on the coast, and the back of it was all swampland, so it was very difficult to get at with any kind of an army.
Library in Alexandria was burned. Is there any sense of what kind of documents were lost?
That's a great question. I don't know. It was so long ago, they probably don't know what was lost. I read something recently that of all the literature produced in the West up to the year 800, only 200 books are extant now of everything, which is just a staggeringly tiny. I mean, I can probably name 10, if we work hard at it, we could easily name 10% of them between the people we've got here in this room, maybe more. So not a lot survived out of the West, and I don't think they know. They do know some of the things that were lost, but I don't know if they, you know, if they had a catalog there that other people had. It's a good question.
They must have lost a lot, though.
Yes. I mean, Alexandria was the center of learning, sort of, in the Eastern Mediterranean, maybe second only to Athens. A number of unfortunate things happened, and kind of gave Christianity a black eye. Those didn't stop either. We had quite a few problems during the medieval times too.
When did you say Plato's Academy ceased?
Plato's Academy ceased during Justinian's rule, about 550 A.D.
And when was the first bubonic plague?
542. Yep.
Was it all the Roman Empire? Or was it just...
Yes, it spread over the whole empire. They had had a couple of plagues actually before then. They called everything plague. But the diseases before then, they think, were measles and smallpox. Contributed, though, to the decline of the Roman Empire, depopulation. The measles and smallpox started in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. And that was one of the reasons, you know, Rome expanded and expanded and expanded, and then they had all this frontier to guard, and they started to lose population. And, you know, they started this sort of downward spiral.
You mentioned a third of Constantinople died.
Right, about
that pretty much across the empire, was it about a third?
Yes.
or the one that we were more familiar with, that plague.
Yeah, that's a great question. The term Dark Ages, you used to always hear it. Everybody say that. It was in the Dark Ages. Well, part of the problem was that different people had different definitions of what the Dark Ages are. Some of them don't even overlap, which I found amazing. And historians now, it's sort of politically not correct to talk about the Dark Ages. But when you look at it, I think there's a real nugget of truth there. From about 600 to about 1,000, I mean, you used to have all this cultural activity in Greece and in Rome, and a lot of that came to pretty much to a halt, with the exception of the Carolingian Renaissance, which maybe we'll talk about another time. There wasn't much literature, there wasn't much philosophy, there wasn't a lot of mathematics. So I think it's, you know, there's at least a nugget of truth to that idea of Dark Ages. But most people started a little bit later than Justinian, maybe 600 to 700. Anything else?
Life's a lot different for the common person, depending on who was it, how it was, it just harsh, brutal, and short, no matter what.
Oh boy, that's a good question. Probably not a lot different for the common person, depending on who was in power. Now, there was a big change in the Roman Empire when Rome crumbled and the barbarians came in. Perhaps not as big a change as it might sound like at first. That was a large change. But other than that, in the earlier periods especially, they probably didn't see a whole lot of difference from one emperor to another. Right in the city of Rome, maybe yes, but especially out in the countryside, no, they didn't see a lot of difference. They might have got taxed more or less. They had the same problems we have. They always needed money. Anything else?
Attila the Hun.
Yes, sir. We're going to talk about him when we do barbarians. But
that's still not part of Rome's crumbling.
I'll give you a little preview. Yes, it is indirectly. Attila came riding out of the steppes and into Central Europe in about 440, around in there somewhere. And what happened when he got here was that the rest of the barbarians were really frightened of these people. When you see what the rest of the barbarians are quoted to have said about the Huns, they were scared to death of them because they were, of the way they fought. They had these really stocky, good horses, and they would shoot arrows from mounted. And they were pretty deadly with that. So there was kind of a billiard ball effect. The Huns came riding in here, and they knocked a bunch of the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths and the Vandals, then started to push down and across the Rhine into the empire. Attila did make one shot in himself. And Pope Gregory, and we'll talk about this, Pope Gregory came up and met him and got him to turn back. And that was one of the reasons that really made Gregory a big hero. And that was a huge boost for the papacy when he did that. So he indirectly had quite a bit to do with it. Directly, a little bit less so. He was happier to sort of hang out here and use the Romans as a convenient place to raid.
If you wanted to do more personal reading on this or even just the history of Christianity too? Do you have a book idea?
I got a lot of this material, not all of it, but quite a bit of this material actually from teaching company courses. Church history books, there's Gonzales, which is a pretty decent one. I've got one by a guy by the name of Everett Ferguson, which is a pretty good one. They talk some about some of the emperors. They don't do a lot with the barbarians, a little bit, but for that you need to go to other sources. There's always Edward Gibbon. If you want to read 2,000 pages, you can always read Gibbon's History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. But that's, yeah, it was written in the 18th century, and it's pretty flowery. It's a tough read. I had to look at it and said, well, I'm going to try some other sources. Anything else? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Randy.